in their front yard, the leaves hanging limp and moveless, their bright colors fading to drab brown. She sighed. If Rennie framed Barbara, then he probably had the newspaper burned down. You know that, right?
I do.
And if Jackie can get Barbara out of jail, where will she put him? Where in town is safe?
I'll have to think about that.
If you can find the generator and turn it off, all this I-spy crap becomes unnecessary.
You pray that happens.
I will. What about radiation? I don't want you coming down with leukemia or something.
I have an idea about that.
Should I ask?
He smiled. Probably not. It's pretty crazy.
She twined her fingers through his. Be careful. He kissed her lightly.
You too.
They looked at Jackie pushing the girls on the swings. They had a lot to be careful for. All the same, Rusty thought that risk was coming into his life as a major factor. If, that was, he wanted to be able to continue looking at his reflection when he took his morning shave.
2. Horace the Corgi liked people food. In fact, Horace the Corgi loved people food. Being a little overweight, not to mention a little gray about the muzzle in these latter years, he wasn't supposed to have it, and Julia had been good about stopping the table feeding after the vet had told her bluntly that her generosity was shortening her housemate's life. That conversation had taken place 16 months ago. Since then, Horace had been restricted to Biljack and the occasional dietetic dog treat. The treats resembled styrofoam packing poppers. And judging from the reproachful way Horace looked at her before eating them, she guessed they probably tasted like packing poppers, too. But she stuck to her guns. No more fried chicken skin. No more cheese doodles. No more bites of her morning donut. This limited Horace's intake of verboten comestibles, but did not entirely end it. The imposed diet simply reduced him to foraging, which Horace rather enjoyed, returning him as it did to the hunting nature of his foxy forebears. His morning and evening walks were especially rich in culinary delights. It was amazing what people left in the gutters along Main Street and West Street, which formed his usual walkie-walk route. There were French fries, potato chips, discarded peanut butter crackers, the occasional ice cream bar wrapper with some chocolate still adhering to it. Once, he came upon an entire table talk pie. It was out of its dish and in his stomach before you could say cholesterol. He didn't succeed in snarking all the goodies he came upon. Sometimes Julia saw what he was after and jerked him along on his leash before he could ingest it. But he got a lot, because Julia often walked him with a book or a folded copy of the New York Times in one hand. Being ignored in favor of the Times wasn't always good, when he wanted a thorough belly scratch, for instance. But during walkies, ignorance was bliss. For small yellow corgis, ignorance meant snacks. He was being ignored this morning. Julia and the other woman. The woman who owned this house, because her smell was all over it, especially in the vicinity of the room where humans went to drop their scat and mark their territory, were talking. Once, the other woman cried, and Julia hugged her.
I'm better.
But not all better, Andrea said.
They were in the kitchen. Horace could smell the coffee they were drinking. Cold coffee, not hot. He could also smell pastries, the kind with icing. I still want it. If she was talking about pastries with icing, so did Horace. The craving may go on for a long time, Julia said. And that's not even the important part. I salute your courage, Andy, but Rusty was right. Cold turkey is foolish and dangerous. You're damn lucky you haven't had a convulsion. For all I know, I have.
Andrea drank some of her coffee. Horace heard the slurp.
I've been having some damned vivid dreams. One was about a fire, a big one, on Halloween. But you're better.
A little.
I'm starting to think I can make it. Julia, you're welcome to stay here with me, but I think you could find a better place.
The smell.
We can do something about the smell. We'll get a battery-powered fan from Burpees. If room and board is a firm offer, one that includes Horace, I'll take you up on it. No one trying to kick an addiction should have to do it on her own. I don't think there's any other way, hon.
You know what I mean. Why did you do it?
Because for the first time since I got elected, this town might need me. And because Jim Rennie threatened to withhold my pills if I objected to his plans.
Horace tuned the rest of this out. He was more interested in a smell wafting to his sensitive nose from the space between the wall and one end of the couch. It was on this couch that Andrea liked to sit in better, if considerably more medicated days, sometimes watching shows like The Hunted Ones, a clever sequel to Lost, and Dancing with the Stars, sometimes a movie on HBO. On movie nights, she often had microwave popcorn. She'd put the bowl on the end table. Because stoners are rarely neat, there was a scattering of popcorn down there below the table. This was what Horace had smelled. But the end table formed a natural bridge, and he was a fairly narrow dog, especially since going on the Corgi version of Weight Watchers. The first kernels were just beyond the Vader file, lying there in its manila envelope. Horace was actually standing on his mistress's name, printed in the late Brenda Perkins' neat hand, and hoovering up the first bits of a surprisingly rich treasure trove when Andrea and Julia walked back into the living room. A woman said, "Take that to her." Horace looked up, his ears pricking. That was not Julia or the other woman. It was a dead voice. Horace, like all dogs, heard dead voices quite often, and sometimes saw their owners. The dead were all around, but living people saw them no more than they could smell most of the 10,000 aromas that surrounded them every minute of every day. "Take that to Julia. She needs it. It's hers." That was ridiculous. Julia would never eat anything that had been in his mouth. Horace knew this from long experience. Even if he pushed it out with his snout, she wouldn't eat it. It was people food, yes, but now it was also floor food.
"Not the popcorn, the..."
"Horace?" Julia asked in that sharp voice that said he was being bad, as in, "Oh, you bad dog, you know better, blah, blah, blah."
"What are you doing back there? Come out."
Horace threw it in reverse. He gave her his most charming grin. "Gosh, Julia, how I love you." Hoping that no popcorn was stuck to the end of his nose. He'd gotten a few pieces, but he sensed the real motherlode had escaped him.
"Have you been foraging?"
Horace sat, looking up at her with the proper expression of adoration, which he did feel. He loved Julia very much. "A better question would be, what have you been foraging?" She bent to look into the gap between the couch and the wall. Before she could, the other woman began to make a gagging noise. She wrapped her arms around herself in an effort to stop a shivering fit, but was unsuccessful. Her smell changed, and Horace knew she was going to yark. He watched closely. Sometimes people yark had good things in it.
"Andy?" Julia asked. "Are you okay?"
Stupid question, Horace thought. Can't you smell her? But that was a stupid question, too. Julia could hardly smell herself when she was sweaty.
"Yes. No. I shouldn't have eaten that raisin bun. I'm going to..."
She hurried out of the room, to add to the smells coming from the piss and scat place, Horace assumed. Julia followed. For a moment, Horace debated squeezing back under the table, but he smelled worry on Julia and hurried at her heels instead. He had forgotten all about the dead voice. 3. Rusty called Claire McClatchy from the car. It was early, but she answered on the first ring, and he wasn't surprised. No one in Chester's Mill was getting much sleep these days, at least not without pharmacological assistance. She promised to have Joe and his friends at the house by 8:30 at the latest. Would pick them up herself, if necessary. Lowering her voice, she said, "I think Joe is crushing on the Calvert girl."
"He'd be a fool not to," Rusty said.
"Will you have to take them out there?"
"Yes, but not into the high radiation zone. I promise you that, Mrs. McClatchy."
"Claire, if I'm going to allow my son to go with you to an area where the animals apparently commit suicide, I think we should be on a first-name basis."
"You get Benny and Nori to your house, and I promise to take care of them on the field trip. That work for you?"
Claire said it did. 5 minutes after hanging up on her, Rusty was turning off an eerily deserted Motton Road and onto Drummond Lane, a short street lined with East Chester's nicest homes. The nicest of the nice was the one with Burpee on the mailbox. Rusty was soon in the Burpee kitchen, drinking coffee, hot. The Burpee generator was still working, with Romeo and his wife, Michaela. Both of them looked pale and grim. Romy was dressed,
Michaela still in her housecoat.
You think that guy Bobby really killed Bren? Romy asked. Because if he did, my friend, I'm going to kill him myself.
Michaela put a hand on his arm.
You ain't that dumb, honey.
I don't think so, Rusty said. I think he was framed. But if you tell people I said that, we could all be in trouble.
Romy always loved that woman.
Michaela was smiling, but there was frost in her voice.
More than me, I sometimes think.
Romy neither confirmed nor denied this, seemed, in fact, not to hear it at all. He leaned toward Rusty, his brown eyes intent.
What you talking about, Doc? Framed how?
Nothing I want to go into now. I'm here on other business, and I'm afraid this is also secret.
Then I don't want to hear it, Michaela said.
She left the room, taking her coffee cup with her.
Ain't gonna be no lovin' from that woman tonight, Romy said. I'm sorry.
Romy shrugged.
I got another one cross town. Misha knows, although she don't let on. Tell me what your other business is, Doc.
Some kids think they may have found what's generating the dome. They're young but smart. I trust them. They had a Geiger counter and they got a radiation spike out on Black Ridge Road. Not into the danger zone, but they didn't get all that close.
Close to what? What'd they see?
A flashing purple light. You know where the old orchard is?
Hell yeah! The McCoy place. I used to take girls parking there. You can see the whole town. I had this old Willis...
He looked momentarily wistful.
Well, never mind.
Just a flashing light.
They also came across a lot of dead animals. Some deer, a bear. Looked to the kids like they committed suicide. Romy regarded him gravely.
I'm going with you.
That's fine, up to a point. One of us has got to go all the way. And that should be me. But I need a radiation suit.
What you got in mind, Doc?
Rusty told him. When he had finished, Romy produced a package of Winstons and offered the pack across the table.
My favorite OPs, Rusty said, and took one. So, what do you think?
Oh, I can help you, Romy said, lighting them up. I got everything in that store of mine, as everyone in this town well knew.
He pointed his cigarette at Rusty.
But you ain't gonna want any pictures of yourself in the paper, because you're gonna look damn funny, you.
Not worried about that, me, Rusty said. Newspaper burned down last night.
I heard, Romy said. That guy Barbara again. His friends.
Do you believe that?
Oh, I'm a believing soul.
When Bush said there was nukes and such in Iraq, I believe that. I tell people he's the guy who knows.
Also believe that Oswald act alone, me.
From the other room, Michaela called,
Stop talking that fake French shit.
Romy gave Rusty a grin that said, You see what I have to put up with? Yes, my dear, he said, and with absolutely no trace of his Lucky Pierre accent. Then he faced Rusty again.
Leave your car here. We'll take my van. More space. Drop me off at the store, then get those kids. I'll put together your radiation suit. But as for gloves, I don't know.
We've got lead-lined gloves in the X-ray room closet at the hospital. Go all the way up to the elbow. I can grab one of the aprons.
Good idea. Hate to see you risk your sperm count.
Also, there might be a pair or two of the lead-lined goggles the Texan radiologist used to wear back in the 70s, although they could have been thrown out. What I'm hoping is that the radiation count doesn't go much higher than the last reading the kids got, which was still in the green.
Except, you said they didn't get all that close.
Rusty sighed. If the needle on that Geiger counter hits 800 or 1,000 counts per second, my continued fertility is going to be the least of my worries. Before they left, Michaela, now dressed in a short skirt and a spectacularly cozy sweater, swept back into the kitchen and berated her husband for a fool. He'd get them in trouble. He'd done it before and would do it again. Only this might be worse trouble than he knew. Romy took her in his arms and spoke to her in rapid French. She replied in the same language, spitting the words. He responded. She beat a fist twice against his shoulder, then cried and kissed him. Outside, Romy turned to Rusty apologetically and shrugged.
She can't help it, he said. She's got the soul of a poet.
and the emotional makeup of a junkyard dog.
4. When Rusty and Romeo Burpee got to the department store, Toby Manning was already there, waiting to open up and serve the public, if that was Romy's pleasure. Petra Searles, who worked across the street in the drugstore, was sitting with him. They were in lawn chairs with tags reading End of Summer Blowout Sale, hanging from the arms.
Sure you don't want to tell me about this radiation suit you're going to build before...
Rusty looked at his watch. 10 o'clock?
Better not, Romy said. You'd call me crazy. Go on, Doc. Get those gloves and goggles and the apron. Talk to the kids. Give me some time.
We opening, boss?
Toby asked when Romy got out.
Dunno. Maybe this afternoon. Gonna be a little busy this morning, me.
Rusty drove away. He was on Town Common Hill before he realized that both Toby and Petra had been wearing blue armbands. 5. He found gloves, aprons, and one pair of lead-lined goggles in the back of the X-ray closet about 2 seconds before he was ready to give up. The goggle strap was busted, but he was sure Romy could staple it back together. As a bonus, he didn't have to explain to anyone what he was doing. The whole hospital seemed to be sleeping. He went back out, sniffed at the air. Flat. With an unpleasant, smoky undertang. And looked west, at the hanging black smear where the missiles had struck. It looked like a skin tumor. He knew he was concentrating on Barbie, and Big Jim, and the murders, because they were the human element. Things he sort of understood. But ignoring the dome would be a mistake. A potentially catastrophic one. It had to go away, and soon. Or his patients with asthma and COPD were going to start having problems. And they were really just the canaries in the coal mine. That nicotine-stained sky. Not good, he muttered, and threw his salvage into the back of the van. Not good at all. 6. All 3 children were at the McClatchy house when he got there, and oddly subdued for kids who might be acclaimed national heroes by the end of this Wednesday in October, if fortune favored them. You guys ready? Rusty asked, more heartily than he felt. Before we go out there, we have to stop at Burpee's, but that shouldn't take l-
They've got something to tell you first, Claire said. I wish to God they didn't. This just keeps getting worse and worse. Would you like a glass of orange juice? We're trying to drink it up before it goes spunky.
Rusty held his thumb and forefinger close together to indicate just a little. He'd never been much of an OJ man, but he wanted her out of the room and sensed she wanted to go. She looked pale and sounded scared. He didn't think this was about what the kids had found out on Black Ridge. This was something else. Just what I need, he thought. When she was gone, he said, Spill it. Benny and Nori turned to Joe. He sighed, brushed his hair off his forehead, sighed again. There was little resemblance between the serious young adolescent and the sign-waving, hell-raising kid in Alden Dinsmore's field 3 days ago. His face was as pale as his mother's, and a few pimples, maybe his first, had appeared on his forehead. Rusty had seen such sudden outbreaks before. They were stress pimples.
What is it, Joe?
People say I'm smart. Joe said,
and Rusty was alarmed to see the kid was on the verge of tears.
I guess I am, but sometimes I wish I wasn't.
Don't worry, Benny said. You're stupid in lots of important ways.
Shut up, Benny,
Nori said kindly. Joe took no notice.
I could beat my dad at chess when I was 6, and my mom by the time I was 8. Get A's in school. Always won the science fair. Been writing my own computer programs for 2 years. I'm not bragging. I know, I'm a geek.
Nori smiled and put her hand on his. He held it.
But I just make connections, see? That's all it is. If A, then B. If not A, then B is out to lunch. And probably the whole alphabet.
What exactly are we talking about, Joe?
I don't think the cook did those murders. That is, we don't.
He seemed relieved when Nori and Benny both nodded. But that was nothing to the look of gladness, mixed with incredulity,
that came over his face when Rusty said, "Neither do I."
"Told you he had made you chops," Benny said. "Gives awesome stitches, too."
Claire came back with juice in a tiny glass. Rusty sipped. Warm, but drinkable. With no Jenny, by tomorrow it wouldn't be.
"Why don't you think he did it?"
Nori asked.
"You guys first."
The generator on Black Ridge had momentarily slipped to the back of Rusty's mind.
"We saw Mrs. Perkins yesterday morning," Joe said. "We were on the common, just starting to prospect with the Geiger counter. She was going uptown Common Hill."
Rusty put his glass on the table next to his chair and sat forward with his hands clasped between his knees.
"What time was this?" "My watch stopped out at the dome on Sunday, so I can't say exactly, but the big fight at the supermarket was going on when we saw her, so it had to be like 9:15. No later than that."
"And no earlier. Because the riot was going on, you heard it?"
"Yeah," Nori said. "It was really loud."
"And you're positive it was Brenda Perkins? It couldn't have been some other woman?"
Rusty's heart was thumping. If she had been seen alive during the riot, then Barbie was indeed in the clear.
"We all know her," Nori said. "She was even my den mother in Girl Scouts before I quit."
The fact that she'd actually been kicked out for smoking did not seem relevant, so she admitted it.
"And I know from Mom what people are saying about the murders," Joe said. "She told me all she knew. You know, the dog tags."
"Mom did not want to tell all she knew," Claire said. "But my son can be very insistent, and this seemed important."
"It is," Rusty said. "Where did Mrs. Perkins go?"
Benny answered this one.
"First to Mrs. Grinnell's, but whatever she said must not have been cool because Mrs. Grinnell slammed the door in her face."
Rusty frowned.
"It's true," Nori said. "I think Mrs. Perkins was delivering her mail or something. She gave an envelope to Mrs. Grinnell. Mrs. Grinnell took it, then slammed the door. Like Benny said."
"Huh," Rusty said. As if there'd been any delivery in Chester's Mill since last Friday.
But what seemed important was that Brenda had been alive and running errands at a time when Barbie was alibied.
"Then where did she go?"
"Cross Main and walked up Mill Street," Joe said.
"This street?"
"Right."
Rusty switched his attention to Claire.
"Did she..."
"She didn't come here," Claire said. "Unless it was while I was down cellar seeing what I have left for canned goods. I was down there for half an hour. Maybe 40 minutes. I wanted to get away from the noise at the market."
Benny said what he'd said the day before.
"Mill Street's 4 blocks long. Lot of houses."
"To me, that's not the important part," Joe said. "I called Anson Wheeler. He used to be a thrasher himself, and he sometimes still takes his board to the pit over in Oxford. I asked him if Mr. Barbara was at work yesterday morning, and he said yes. He said Mr. Barbara went down to Food City when the riot started. He was with Anson and Ms. Twitchell from then on. So, Mr. Barbara's alibied for Ms. Perkins, and remember what I said about if not A, then not B, not the whole alphabet?"
Rusty thought the metaphor was a little too mathematical for human affairs, but he understood what Joe was saying. There were other victims for whom Barbie might not have an alibi, but the same body dump argued strongly for the same killer. And if Big Jim had done at least one of the victims, as the stitch marks on Coggin's face suggested, then he had likely done them all. Or it might have been Junior. Junior, who was now wearing a gun and carrying a badge.
"We need to go to the police, don't we?"
Nori said.
"I'm scared about that. I'm really, really scared about that. What if Rennie killed Brenda Perkins? He lives on this street, too."
"That's what I said yesterday," Nori told her.
"And doesn't it seem likely that if she went to see one selectman and got the door slammed in her face, she'd then go on and try the next one in the neighborhood?"
Joe said, rather indulgently,
"I doubt if there's any connection, Mom."
"Maybe not, but she still could have been going to see Jim Rennie. And Peter Randolph..."
She shook her head.
"When Big Jim says jump, Peter asks, How high?
Good one, Mrs. McClatchy, Benny cried. You rule, oh mother of my...
Thank you, Benny, but in this town, Jim Rennie rules.
What do we do?
Joe was looking at Rusty with troubled eyes. Rusty thought of the smudge again. The yellow sky. The smell of smoke in the air. He also spared a thought for Jackie Weddington's determination to break Barbie out.
Dangerous as it might be, it was probably a better chance for the guy than the testimony of three kids. Especially when the police chief receiving it was just about capable of wiping his ass without an instruction booklet.
Right now, nothing. Dale Barber's safe right where he is. Rusty hoped this was true. We've got this other thing to deal with. If you really found the dome generator and we can turn it off...
The rest of the problems will just about solve themselves,
Nori Calvert said.
She looked profoundly relieved. They actually might, Rusty said.
7. After Petra Searles went back to the drugstore, to do inventory, she said, Toby Manning asked Romy if he could help with anything. Romy shook his head.
Go on home. See what you can do for your dad and mom.
It's just dad, Toby said. Mom went to a supermarket over in Castle Rock Saturday morning. She says the prices at Food City are too high. What are you going to do?
Nothing much, Romy said vaguely. Tell me something, Tubes. Why are you and Petra wearing those blue rags around your arms?
Toby glanced at it as if he'd forgotten it was there.
Just showing solidarity, he said. After what happened last night at the hospital, after everything that's been happening.
Romy nodded.
You ain't deputized, no nothing.
Heck no, it's more... You remember after 9/11 when it seemed like everybody had a New York Fire Department or Police Department hat and shirt? It's like that,
he considered.
I guess if they needed help, I'd be glad to pitch in, but it seems like they're doing fine. You sure you don't need help?
Yeah, no, Skett. I'll call you if I decide to open this afternoon.
Okay.
Toby's eyes gleamed.
Maybe we could have a dome sale. You know what they say, when life hands you lemons, make lemonade.
Maybe. Maybe, Romy said. But he doubted there would be any such sale.
This morning he was much less interested than he had been in unloading shoddy goods at prices that looked like bargains. He felt that he had undergone big changes in the last 3 days, not so much of character as of perspective. Some of it had to do with fighting the fire and the camaraderie afterward. That had been the real town at work, he thought, the town's better nature. And a lot of it had to do with the murder of his once-upon-a-time lover, Brenda Perkins, whom Romy still thought of as Brenda Morse. One hot ticket she'd been. And if he discovered who had cooled her off, assuming that Rusty was right about it not being Dale Barbara, that person would pay. Romy Burpee would see to that personally. At the back of his cavernous store was the home repair section, conveniently located next to the do-it-yourself section. Romy grabbed a set of heavy-duty metal snips from the ladder, then entered the former, and proceeded to the farthest, darkest, and dustiest corner of his retail kingdom. Here, he found 2 dozen 50-pound rolls of Santa Rosa lead sheeting, ordinarily used for roofing, flashing, and chimney insulation. He loaded 2 of the rolls, and the metal snips, into a shopping cart, and rolled the cart back through the store until he reached the sports department. Here, he set to work picking and choosing. Several times he burst out laughing. It was going to work, but yes, Rusty Everett was going to look très amusant. When he was done, he straightened up to stretch the kinks out of his back and caught sight of a deer in the Crosshairs poster on the far side of the sports department. Printed above the deer was this reminder, "Hunting season's almost here. Time to gun up." Given the way things were going, Romy thought that gunning up might be a good idea, especially if Rennie or Randolph decided that confiscating any weapons but those belonging to the cops would be a good idea. He rolled another shopping cart over to the locked rifle cases, working through the considerable ring of keys hanging from his belt by touch alone. Burpee sold exclusively Winchester products, and given that deer season was only a week away, Romy thought he could justify a few holes in his stock if he were asked. He selected a Wildcat 22, a speed pump Black Shadow, and 2 black Defenders, also with the speed pump feature. To this he added a Model 70 Extreme Weather, with scope, and a 70 featherweight without. He took ammo for all the guns, then pushed the cart down to his office and stowed the guns in his old green Defender floor safe. This is paranoid, you know, he thought, as he twirled the dial. But it didn't feel paranoid. And as he went back out to wait for Rusty and the kids, he reminded himself to tie a blue rag around his arm. And to tell Rusty to do the same. Camouflage wasn't a bad idea. Any deer hunter knew that. 8. At 8 o'clock that morning, Big Jim was back in his home study. Carter Thibodeau, now his personal bodyguard for the duration, Big Jim had decided, was deep in an issue of Car and Driver, reading a comparison of the 2012 BMW H car and the 2011 Ford Vesper RT. They both look like awesome cars, but anybody who didn't know that BMWs ruled was insane. The same was true, he thought, of anyone who didn't understand that Mr. Rennie was now the BMW H car of Chester's Mill. Big Jim was feeling quite well, partly because he'd gotten another hour of sleep after visiting Barbara. He was going to need lots of power naps in the days ahead. He had to stay sharp on top. He would not quite admit to himself that he was also worried about more arrhythmias. Having Thibodeau on hand eased his mind considerably, especially with Junior behaving so erratically. That's one way to put it, he thought. Thibodeau looked like a thug, but he seemed to have a feel for the aide-de-camp role. Big Jim wasn't completely sure yet, but he thought Thibodeau might actually turn out to be smarter than Randolph. He decided to test that. How many men guard in the supermarket, son, do you know? Carter put his magazine aside and drew a battered little notebook from his back pocket. Big Jim approved. After thumbing through it a little, Carter said,
5 last night. 3 regular guys and 2 new ones. No problems. Today there's only going to be 3. All new ones. Aubrey Toll, his brother owns the bookshop, you know. Todd Wendelstadt and Lauren Connery.
And do you concur that that should be enough?
Huh?
Do you agree, Carter? Concur means agree.
Yeah, that should do it.
Daylight and all.
No pause to calculate what the boss might want to hear.
Rennie liked that a bunch. Okay. Now, listen. I want you to get with Stacy Moggin this morning. Tell her to call every officer we've got in our roster. I want them all at Food City tonight at 7. I'm going to talk to them. Actually, he was going to make another speech, this time with all the stops out. Wind them up like Granddad's pocket watch.
Okay.
Carter made a note in his little aide-de-camp book.
And tell each of them to try and bring 1 more.
Carter was running his nod upon pencil down the list in his book.
We've already got, 26.
That still might not be enough. Remember the market yesterday morning and the Shumway woman's newspaper last night? It's us or anarchy, Carter. Do you know the meaning of that word?
Yes, sir.
Carter Thibodeau was pretty sure it meant an archery range, and he supposed his new boss was saying that the mill could become a shooting gallery or something if they didn't take a good hard hold.
Maybe we ought to make a weapons sweep or something.
Big Jim grinned. Yes, in many ways, a delightful boy.
That's on the docket, probably starting next week.
If the dome's still up. You think it will be?
I think so.
It had to be. There was still so much to do. He had to see that the propane cache was disseminated back into town. All traces of the meth lab behind the radio station had to be erased. Also, and this was crucial, he hadn't achieved his greatness yet, although he was well on his way.
In the meantime, have a couple of the officers, the regular officers, go on over to Burpee's and confiscate the guns there. If Romeo Burpee gives the officers any grief, they're to say we want to keep them out of the hands of Dale Barbara's friends. Have you got that?
Yep.
Carter made another note.
Denton and Weddington, they okay?
Big Jim frowned. Weddington, the gal with the big titties. He didn't trust her. He wasn't sure he would have liked any cop with titties. Gals had no business in law enforcement, but it was more than that. It was the way she looked at him.
Freddie Denton, yes. Weddington, no. Not Henry Morrison, either.
Send Denton and George Frederick. Tell them to put the guns in the PD strong room.
Got it.
Rennie's phone rang and his frown deepened. He picked it up and said, Selectman Rennie.
Hello, Selectman. This is Colonel James O. Cox. I'm in charge of what's being called the Dome Project. I thought it was time we spoke.
Big Jim leaned back in his chair, smiling. Well, then you just go on then, Colonel, and God bless you.
My information is that you've arrested the man the President of the United States tapped to take charge of matters in Chester's Mill.
That would be correct, sir. Mr. Barber's charged with murder. 4 counts.
I hardly think the President would want a serial killer in charge of things.
Wouldn't do much for standing in the polls.
Which puts you in charge.
Oh, no, Rennie said, smiling more widely. I'm nothing but a humble second, Selectman. Andy Sanders is the man in charge, and Peter Randolph, our new police chief, as you may know, was the arresting officer.
Your hands are clean, in other words. That's going to be your position once the dome is gone and the investigation starts. Big Jim enjoyed the frustration he heard in the cotton picker's voice. Pentagon's son of a buck was used to riding. Being rode was a new experience for him.
Why would they be dirty, Colonel Cox? Barbara's dog tags were found with one of the victims. Can't get much more cut and dried than that.
Convenient.
Call it what you want.
If you tune in the cable news networks, Cox said, you'll see that serious questions are being raised about Barbara's arrest, especially in light of his service record, which is exemplary. Questions are also being raised about your own record, which is not so exemplary.
Do you think any of that surprises me? You fellows are good at managing the news. You've been doing it since Vietnam.
CNN's got a story about you being investigated for shady bait-and-switch practices back in the late 90s. NBC's reporting that you were investigated for unethical loan practices in 2008. I believe you were accused of charging illegal rates of interest, somewhere in the 40% area, then repoing cars and trucks that had already been paid for twice and sometimes 3 times over. Your constituents are probably seeing this on the news for themselves. All those charges had gone away. He had paid good money to make them go away.
The people in my town know those news shows will put on any ridiculous thing if it sells a few more tubes of hemorrhoid cream and a few more bottles of sleeping pills.
There's more. According to the state of Maine Attorney General, the previous police chief, the one who died last Saturday, was investigating you for tax fraud, misappropriation of town funds and town property, and involvement in illegal drug activity. We have released none of this latest stuff to the press and have no intention of doing so if you'll compromise. Step down as town selectman. Mr. Sanders should likewise step down. Name Andrea Grinnell, the third selectman, as the officer in charge, and Jacqueline Weddington as the president's representative in Chester's Mill. Big Jim was startled out of what remained of his good temper.
Man, are you insane? Andy Grinnell is a drug addict, hooked on OxyContin.
And the Weddington woman doesn't have a brain in her cotton-picking head. I assure you, that's not true, Rennie.
No more, mister. The era of good feelings seemed to be over.
Weddington was given a citation for helping to break up an illegal drug ring operation out of the 67th Combat Support Hospital in Würzburg, Germany, and was personally recommended by a man named Jack Reacher, the toughest goddamn army cop that ever served, in my humble opinion.
There's nothing humble about you, sir. And your sacrilegious language doesn't go down well with me. I am a Christian.
A drug-selling Christian, according to my information.
Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me.
Especially under the dome, Big Jim thought, and smiled.
Do you have any actual proof?
Come on, Rennie. As one hard-ass to another, does it matter? The dome is a bigger press event than 9/11. And it's sympathetic, Big Press. If you don't start compromising, I'll tar you so thick you'll never get it off. Once the dome breaks, I'll see you before a Senate subcommittee, a grand jury, and in jail. I promise you that. But step down, and it all goes away. I promise you that, too.
Once the dome breaks, Rennie mused, and when will that be?
Maybe sooner than you think. I plan to be the first one inside.
and my first order of business will be to snap handcuffs on you and escort you to an airplane which will fly you to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where you will be held as a guest of the United States pending trial. Big Jim was rendered momentarily speechless by the bold-faced audacity of this. Then he laughed. If you really wanted what's best for the town, Rennie, you'd step down. Look what's happened on your watch. 6 murders. 2 at the hospital last night, we understand. A suicide and a food riot. You're not up to this job. Big Jim's hand closed on the gold baseball and squeezed. Carter Thibodeau was looking at him with a worried frown. If you were here, Colonel Cox, I'd give you a taste of what I gave Coggins. With God as my witness, I would. Rennie?
I'm here.
He paused.
And you're there.
Another pause.
And the dome isn't coming down. I think we both know that. Drop the biggest A-bomb you've got on it. Render the surrounding towns uninhabitable for 200 years. Kill everybody in Chester's Mill with the radiation if the radiation goes through. And still, it won't come down.
He was breathing fast now, but his heart was beating strong and steady in his chest.
Because the dome is God's will.
Which was, in his deepest heart, what he believed. As he believed, it was God's will that he take this town and carry it through the weeks, months, and years ahead.
What? Ye heard me.
Knowing he was wagering everything, his entire future, on the continued existence of the dome. Knowing some people would think he was crazy for doing so. Also knowing those people were unbelieving heathens, like Colonel James O. Cotton Picker Cox.
Rennie, be reasonable. Please.
Big Jim liked that, please. It brought his good humor back in a rush.
Let's recap, shall we, Colonel Cox? Andy Sanders is in charge here, not me. Although I appreciate the courtesy call from such a high mucky-muck as yourself, naturally. And while I'm sure Andy will appreciate your offer to manage things by remote control, as it were, I think I can speak for him when I say you can take your offer and tuck it away where the sun doesn't shine. We're on our own in here, and we're going to handle it on our own.
You're crazy,
Cox said wonderingly.
So unbelievers always call the religious. It's their final defense against faith. We're used to it. And I don't hold it against you.
This was a lie.
May I ask a question?
Go on.
Are you going to cut off our phones and computers?
You'd sort of like that, wouldn't you?
Of course not.
Another lie. The phones and internet stay, so does the press conference on Friday, at which you'll be asked some difficult questions, I assure you.
I won't be attending any press conferences in the foreseeable future, Colonel. Neither will Andy, and Mrs. Grinnell wouldn't make much sense, poor thing. So you can just cancel your...
Oh, no, not at all. Was that a smile in Cox's voice? The press conference will be held at noon on Friday, and plenty of time to sell lots of hemorrhoid cream on the evening news.
And who do you expect will be attending from our town?
Everyone, Rennie. Absolutely everyone. Because we're going to allow their relatives to come to the dome at the Motton Town Line. Site of the airplane crash in which Mr. Sanders' wife died, you may remember. The press will be there to record the whole thing. It's going to be like visiting day at the state prison. Only no one's guilty of anything. Except maybe you. Rennie was infuriated all over again.
You can't do that.
Oh, but I can. The smile was there. You can sit on your side of the dome and thumb your nose at me. I can sit on mine and do the same. The visitors will be lined up, and as many as will agree to do so will be wearing T-shirts reading, Dale Barbara is innocent, and free Dale Barbara, and impeach James Rennie. There will be tearful reunions, hands pressing against hands with the dome in between, maybe even attempts to kiss. It will make excellent TV footage, and it will make excellent propaganda. Most of all, it's going to make people in your town wonder what they're doing with an incompetent like you at the controls. Big Jim's voice descended to a thick growl.
I won't allow it.
How are you going to stop it? Over 1,000 people. You couldn't shoot them all. When he spoke again, his voice was calm and reasonable.
Come on, Selectman. Let's work this out. You can still come out of it clean. You only need to let go of the controls.
Big Jim saw Junior drifting down the hall toward the front door like a ghost, still wearing his pajama pants and slippers and barely noticed. Junior could have dropped dead in the hallway and Big Jim would have remained hunched over his desk, the gold baseball clutched in one hand and the telephone in the other. One thought beat in his head. Putting Andrea Grinnell in charge, with Officer Titties as her second. It was a joke. A bad joke. Colonel Cox, you can go fuck yourself. He hung up, swiveled his desk chair, and hurled the gold baseball. It hit the signed photo of Tiger Woods. The glass shattered, the frame fell to the floor, and Carter Thibodeau, who was used to striking fear into hearts, but who rarely had fear struck into his own, jumped to his feet.
Mr. Rennie, are you all right?
He didn't look all right. Irregular purple patches flared in his cheeks. His small eyes were wide and bulging from their sockets of hard fat. The vein in his forehead pulsed.
They will never take this town from me,
Big Jim whispered.
Course they won't, Carter said. Without you, we're sunk.
This relaxed Big Jim to some degree. He reached for the telephone, then remembered Randolph had gone home to bed. The new chief had gotten precious little rack time since the crisis began and had told Carter that he intended to sleep until at least noon, and that was okay. The man was useless anyway.
Carter, make a note. Show it to Morrison if he's running things at the PD this morning. Then leave it on Randolph's desk. After that, come right back here.
He paused to consider for a moment, frowning.
See if Junior's headed there. He went out while I was talking to Colonel Do-What-I-Want on the telephone. Don't go looking for him if he's not, but if he is, make sure he's all right.
Sure. What's the message?
Dear Chief Randolph, Jacqueline Weddington is to be severed from the Chester's Mill PD immediately.
Does that mean fired?
Yes, indeed.
Carter was scribbling in his book, and Big Jim gave him time to catch up. He was okay again. Better than okay. He was feeling it.
Add, Dear Officer Morrison, when Weddington comes in today, please inform her she is relieved of duty and tell her to clean out her locker. If she asks you for a cause, tell her we are reorganizing the department and her services will no longer be required.
Does required have a C in it, Mr. Rennie?
The spelling doesn't matter, the message matters.
Okay, right.
If she has further questions, she can see me.
Got it. Is that all?
No. Tell whichever one sees her first to take her badge and gun. If she gets poopy and says the gun's her personal property, they can give her a receipt and tell her it will either be returned or she'll be reimbursed when this crisis is over.
Carter scribbled some more, then looked up.
What do you think is wrong with Junes, Mr. Rennie?
I don't know. Just migraines, I imagine. Whatever it is, I don't have time to deal with it right now. There are more pressing matters at hand.
He pointed at the notebook.
Bring me that.
Carter did. His handwriting was the looping scrawl of a third grader. But everything was there. Rennie signed it. 9. Carter took the fruits of his secretarial labor to the PD. Henry Morrison greeted them with an incredulity that fell just short of mutiny. Carter also looked around for Junior, but Junior wasn't there and no one had seen him. He asked Henry to keep an eye out. Then, on impulse, he went downstairs to visit Barbie, who was lying on his bunk with his hands behind his head.
Your boss called, he said. That guy Cox. Mr. Rennie calls him Colonel Do-What-I-Want.
I'll bet he does, Barbie said.
Mr. Rennie gave him the big fuck you. And you know what? Your army pal had to eat it and smile. What do you think of that?
I'm not surprised.
Barbie kept looking at the ceiling. He sounded calm. It was irritating. Carter, have you thought about where all this is going? Have you tried taking the long view?
There isn't any long view, Barbie.
Not anymore.
Barbie just kept looking at the ceiling with a little smile dimpling the corners of his mouth, as if he knew something Carter did not,
It made Carter want to unlock the cell door and punch the shitlicker's lights out. Then he remembered what had happened in Dipper's parking lot. Let Barbara see if he could fight a firing squad with his dirty tricks. Let him try that.
I'll see you around,
Barbie. I'm sure, Barbie said, still not bothering to look at him. It's a small town, son, and we all support the team. 10. When the parsonage doorbell rang, Piper Libby was still in the Bruins t-shirt and shorts that served as her nightwear. She opened the door, assuming her visitor would be Helen Rue, an hour early for her 10 o'clock appointment to discuss George's funeral and burial arrangements. But it was Jackie Weddington. She was wearing her uniform, but there was no badge over her left breast and no gun on her hip. She looked stunned.
Jackie? What's wrong?
I've been fired. That bastard has had it in for me since the PD Christmas party, when he tried to cop a feel and I slapped his hand, but I doubt if that was all of it, or even most of it.
Come in, Piper said. I found a little gas-operated hot plate from the last minister, I think, in one of the pantry cupboards, and for a wonder it still works. Doesn't a cup of hot tea sound good?
Wonderful, Jackie said. Tears welled in her eyes and overspilled. She wiped them off her cheeks almost angrily.
Piper led her into the kitchen and lit the single-burner Brinkman camp grill on the counter.
Now, tell me everything.
Jackie did, not failing to include Henry Morrison's condolences, which had been clumsy but sincere.
He whispered that part, she said, taking the cup Piper gave her. It's like the goddamn Gestapo over there now. Excuse my language.
Piper waved this away.
Henry says that if I protest at the town meeting tomorrow, I'll only make things worse. Rennie'll whip out a bunch of trumped-up incompetency charges. He's probably right, but the biggest incompetent in the department this morning is the one running the place. As for Rennie, he's packing the PD with officers who'll be loyal to him, in case of any organized protest to the way he's doing things.
Of course he is,
Piper said.
Most of the new hires are too young to buy a legal beer, but they're carrying guns. I thought of telling Henry he'd be the next to go. He's said things about the way Randolph's running the department, and of course the bootlickers will have passed his comments on. But I could see by his face that he already knows it.
Do you want me to go see Rennie?
It wouldn't do any good. I'm actually not sorry to be out. I just hate to be fired. The big problem is that I'll look very good for what's going to happen tomorrow night. I may have to disappear with Barbie. Always assuming we can find a place to disappear, too.
I don't understand what you're talking about.
I know, but I'm going to tell you. And this is where the risks start. If you don't keep this to yourself, I'll wind up in the coop myself, maybe even standing next to Barbara when Rennie lines up his firing squad.
Piper regarded her gravely.
I've got 45 minutes before George Aru's mother shows up. Is that time enough for you to say what you have to say?
Plenty.
Jackie began with the examination of the bodies at the funeral home, described the stitch marks on Coggin's face, and the golden baseball Rusty had seen. She took a deep breath, and next spoke of her plan to break Barbie out during the special town meeting the following night. Although, I have no idea where we can put him if we do get him out. She sipped her tea.
So, what do you think? That I want another cup, are you?
I'm good. Thanks.
From the counter, Piper said,
What you're planning is terribly dangerous. I doubt if you need me to tell you that. But there may be no other way to save an innocent man's life. I never believed for a second that Dale Barbara was guilty of those murders. And after my own close encounter with our local law enforcement, the idea that they'd execute him to keep him from taking over doesn't surprise me much.
Then, following Barbie's train of thought without knowing it,
Rennie isn't taking the long view, and neither are the cops. All they care about is who's boss of the treehouse. That kind of thinking is a disaster waiting to happen.
She came back to the table.
I've known almost from the day I came back here to take up the pastorate, which was my ambition ever since I was a little girl, that Jim Rennie was a monster in embryo. Now, if you'll pardon the melodramatic turn of phrase, the monster has been born.
Thank God, Jackie said.
Thank God the monster has been born?
Piper smiled and raised her eyebrows.
No, thank God you're down with this.
There's more, isn't there?
Yes, unless you don't want to be a part of it.
Honey, I'm already a part of it. If you can be jailed for plotting, I could be jailed for listening and not reporting. We're now what our government likes to call homegrown terrorists.
Jackie received this idea in glum silence.
It isn't just Freedale Barber you're talking about, is it? You want to organize an active resistance movement.
I suppose I do, Jackie said, and gave a rather helpless laugh. After 6 years with the U.S. Army, I never would have expected it. I've always been a my country right or wrong sort of girl, but has it occurred to you that the dome might not break? Not this fall, not this winter. Maybe not next year or even in our lifetimes.
Yes.
Piper was calm, but most of the color had left her cheeks.
It has. I think it's occurred to everyone in the mill, if only in the backs of their minds.
Then think about this. Do you want to spend a year or 5 years in a dictatorship run by a homicidal idiot? Assuming we have 5 years.
Of course not.
Then the only time to stop him might be now. He may no longer be in embryo, but this thing he's building, this machine, is still in its infancy. It's the best time.
Jackie paused.
If he orders the police to start collecting guns from ordinary citizens, it might be the only time.
What do you want me to do?
Let us have a meeting here, at the parsonage, tonight. These people, if they'll all come. From her back pocket, she took the list she and Linda Everett had labored over. Piper unfolded the sheet of notebook paper and studied it. There were 8 names. She looked up.
Lissa Jameson, the librarian with the crystals.
Ernie Calvert, are you sure about those two? Who better to recruit than a librarian when you're dealing with a fledgling dictatorship? As for Ernie, my understanding is that after what happened at the supermarket yesterday, if he came across Jim Rennie flaming in the street, he wouldn't piss on him to put him out.
Pronounly vague, but otherwise colorful.
I was going to have Julia Shumway sound Ernie and Lissa out, but now I'll be able to do it myself. I seem to have come into a lot of free time.
The doorbell rang.
That may be the bereaved mother, Piper said, getting to her feet. I imagine she'll be half shot already. She enjoys her coffee brandy, but I doubt if it dulls the pain much. You haven't told me how you feel about the meeting, Jackie said.
Piper Libby smiled.
Tell our fellow homegrown terrorists to arrive between 9 and 9:30 tonight. They should come on foot and by ones, standard French resistance stuff. No need to advertise what we're doing.
Thank you, Jackie said.
So much.
Not at all. It's my town, too. May I suggest you slip out by the back door?
11. There was a pile of clean rags in the back of Romy Burpee's van. Rusty knotted two of them together, fashioning a bandana he tied over the lower half of his face. But still his nose, throat, and lungs were thick with the stench of dead bear. The first maggots had hatched in its eyes, open mouth, and the meat of its exposed brain. He stood up, backed away, then reeled a little bit. Romy grabbed him by the elbow.
If he passes out, catch him, Joe said nervously. Maybe that thing hits adults further out.
It's just the smell, Rusty said. I'm okay now.
But even away from the bear, the world smelled bad. Smoky and heavy, as if the entire town of Chester's Mill had become a large closed room. In addition to the odors of smoke and decaying animal, he could smell rotting plant life, and a swampy stench that no doubt arose from the drying bed of the Prestille. If only there was a wind, he thought, but there was just an occasional pallid puff of breeze that brought more bad smells. To the far west there were clouds. It was probably raining a bitch over in New Hampshire. But when they reached the dome, the clouds parted like a river dividing at a large outcropping of rock. Rusty had become increasingly doubtful about the possibility of rain under the dome. He made a note to check some meteorological websites, if he ever got a free moment. Life had become appallingly busy and unsettlingly unstructured.
Did Br'er Bear maybe die of rabies, Doc? Romy asked.
I doubt it. I think it's exactly what the kid said. Plain suicide. They piled into the van, Romy behind the wheel, and drove slowly up Black Ridge Road. Rusty had the Geiger counter in his lap. It clucked steadily. He watched the needle rise toward the plus 200 mark.
Stop here, Mr. Burpee,
Nori cried. Before you come out of the woods, if you're going to pass out, I'd just as soon you didn't do it while you were driving, even at 10 miles an hour.
Romeo obediently pulled the van over.